Yeah, it's really easy to do radio in Guelph. I'm just messing. jokes. Okay, you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Vince, so stolid today.
Yes, that's my that's my pre-end credits game face.
You gotta psych yourself up for the show by psyching yourself down.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a very intense process.
Okay, well, hope it was worth it. End Credits is the local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the news movies, which this week will be the latest Pixar film, Toy Story 4. And that's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including Mouse Guard, a film based on the comic book series, and was canceled after the Fox-Disney merger, but might an info dump of all the film's artwork start a groundswell of fan support to get it made? And then Deepfake is showing us a glimpse of the Last Action Hero universe where Sylvester Stallone played the Terminator. But could the technology let such a thing really come to pass? And then finally, we'll talk about some of the new trailers that came out last week, including The Good Liar, Midway, and Charlie's Angels. But first, hashtag release the Snyder Cut. It's been almost 2 years since Justice League came out, but fans are still obsessed with seeing Zack Snyder's original intention for Justice League for some reason.
I don't know. I went to the barber and asked for a Snyder cut, and he just made it longer and worse.
Oh my God.
That's it.
How long have you had that one put away?
At least 3 days. At least 3 days, Adam. There we go.
It was pretty good. It was pretty good.
All right. All right. Cool. Well, I liked your emphasis on the release the Snyder.
Release the Snyder cut.
Yeah.
It's a it's phrased like it's a conspiracy.
So is it possible that these fans are just delusional in thinking that there is a good version of this film out there somewhere?
I don't know if there's a good version of this film because it's Zack Snyder made it.
Right. So he delivered a rough cut, I guess, to Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers did what they did, and now we don't know what version he did. Is that correct?
Okay. To recap, Zack Snyder made this movie called Justice League. He shot it.
Right.
And then put out a rough cut. He showed it to friends and people at the studio. It needed completion. It was still, you know, in VFX and everything. And then his daughter took her own life.
Mm-hmm.
He was supposed to go for scheduled reshoots, but felt it was probably the wrong time to leave his family in California and go to England to do reshoots for Justice League. He was already working with Joss Whedon on reshoots. And all big movies have reshoots to an extent. I'm not telling you this, Vince, because you know this, but I'm telling the audience that, you know, you get something in the editing room and you find out that you need a scene that connects two different scenes together. You know, the film is in a constant state of sort of being rewritten.
One of the reasons why the Fantastic Four with Josh Trank was so bad, because it was just so unintelligible the first time and they had to do so many reshoots to try and make sense of it.
True. So it's not an unusual thing. It's not an automatic indictment of badness.
Right.
Although when you see a really bad movie and you hear there are reshoots, we tend to tie the two together. But between Zack Snyder leaving the project and Joss Whedon doing reshoots, Warner Brothers realized they had a problem with the darkness, the overwhelming darkness and grittiness, and basically turned it over to Joss Whedon to basically punch it up. And no one knows, although you can probably guess what stuff is Joss Whedon's and what stuff is Zack Snyder's when you watch the finished film. But nobody knows for sure how much of the quote-unquote Snyder cut, I put air quotes there,
was
some people say it's 70, 80, 90%, but I mean, it would still end up costing probably millions of dollars.
So now there's a new head of Warner Brothers and people are pressuring her to release this cut?
On the first day, her first day being the head of one of the five major
Hollywood
studios.
Now, about that Snyder cut.
Yeah. Hey, lady, release the Snyder cut.
Yeah.
It's like, we know it's your first day, but like, we really want this. And
No pressure or anything, just...
Right. It's it's fascinating the lengths that people would go to. They've raised $20,000 to basically bombard Comic-Con in San Diego next month with like leafleteers and bus shelter ads like demanding the release of the Snyder Cut. And Warner Brothers doesn't even have like a booth. Well, they might have a booth there, but they don't have like a presentation. They're not going to have a huge presence at this year's Comic-Con, so there's going to be no like DC stuff. There's, you know, they're basically going to be yelling into the void, although some people think that's going to be to their advantage. But I mean, the people they want to influence in terms of like the people at the studio aren't going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Which seems
so it's not that the studio doesn't want to release this cut, it's just that they don't, it's not on their radar, I guess.
I don't, well, I can't say for sure what this, I mean, because I saw one article, I think it was on The Ringer, where somebody said, someone who knows, like, sort of the thinking in the back rooms of studios was like, it's a lose-lose proposition for Warner Brothers if they release it. It's a lose on the one hand because you have to, like, spend all this money and you have no idea if you're going to redeem it or not. Like, is there really like millions of people who would race out and buy Justice League again or go to the theater and see Justice League again to see the quote unquote Snyder Cut? And then it's also a lose on the other hand, because if you release the Snyder Cut and it turns out that fans receive it better than the original Justice League, which I think is probably unlikely to happen, you look like an idiot for the first place for like undertaking millions and millions of dollars in rewrites and reshoots and covering Henry Cavill's mustache with CG skin and these things. So, you know, Warner Brothers isn't in the losing business,
mm-hmm.
not intentionally. And what this guy is saying, like, either way, they lose.
Right. Yeah.
So
maybe we can focus our attention on something more important. How about that?
Well,
take all that energy you're putting towards Justice League and put it towards, I don't know.
I wonder. I mean, it seems like one of these things where they're kind of amplifying. If we're amplifying like a relatively small chorus, you know, people who can, you know, sound louder than they are because they're on social media.
We've raised X amount of dollars and we have X amount of followers and whatever. It's like,
right, because it's, I think there was overwhelming agreement that Batman versus Superman movie, which was Zack Snyder, like it was sort of like Zack Snyder set loose, given the creative reins, and it was not well received.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of fans were disappointed by it. Critics were disappointed on it. I think it made like $800 million at the worldwide box office. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but I mean, these big Hollywood movies are sort of on a curve because it costs so much to make them. But you have the two biggest superheroes ever, Batman and Superman, in the same movie for the first time, and all it makes is $800 million. Meanwhile, Aquaman alone makes like $1.5 billion worldwide. Yeah. I mean, that should be like an indication that Warner Brothers is sort of making the right call, trying to move away from the Zack Snyder vision of this, which is like having, you know, Batman and Superman like talking deep voices, I'm gonna make you bleed, to each other
and beat up like shadowy government agents with guns and whatever. And it's
right, and you know, like it just seems like this is a very small contingent of people who A, don't know how Hollywood works, as we've talked about before with like the Game of Thrones and people, and B, don't understand that if you make a movie with Batman and Superman and it only makes $800 million, you screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
Because that movie should have made $1 billion in its first 3 days, because people know those heroes, people love those heroes, and if you can make $1 billion with Iron Man, who nobody knew before Robert Downey Jr. stepped foot in his boots, you really don't understand the market, and you don't understand the characters and where this comes from.
Yeah. Oh, you don't need to understand anything anymore. You can just go voice yourself on the internet.
Right. It's anyway, it's kind of sad. And I think Zack Snyder is definitely a creative dude. I'm not a Snyder hater by any stretch of the imagination, but his worldview just did not fit like the mainstream superhero films. It fits something like Watchmen, which is dark and cynical and distrustful of power and people who have power. But that's not Superman. That's not like the mainstream hero universe. And, you know, I think when you watch the finished Justice League movie, when you have these like two competing things with like Whedon's optimism and Snyder's pessimism,
it's just a mishmash. It's a mishmash of wrong perspectives or visions, rather.
Visions.
It's just a misfire of visions.
But in the review we did on this show about Justice League, what I said is like, I didn't leave Justice League feeling like an overwhelming sense of clinical depression like I did watching Batman versus Superman.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, that alone should be a win. What is not a win, at least for fans of another comic book, Mouse Guard, is that movie is not going forward. Maybe because of that, and he said also because of the hours and hours that several artists spent on designing and putting together visuals for the film. Director Wes Ball dumped all that work on the internet. All these concepts, all these pre-visuals, these completed segments, which are actually really beautiful.
I wasn't familiar with any of the Mouse Guard comics or the source material originally.
Mm-hmm.
Were you?
Yeah, I have a couple of Mouse Guards in my collection. Okay. It's, for people who don't know, it comes out bi-monthly, so it's not like a regular thing.
Mm-hmm.
It comes out 6 times a year instead of 12 times a year like most comic books. It's shaped more like a children's book. It's not the conventional comic book size. And it's like, I think he uses watercolors in the artwork. So it's like very, very lush. It's very, it doesn't look like a typical comic book either. It's in a very storybook style. So, I mean, when you look at the CG renderings for the for the movie, that's a very different style too. But the comic book itself is very, very funky, very, very different.
So to be clear, Disney bought Fox, and as a result of the price they paid, they could not financially move forward with this Mouse Guard movie?
Well, I think Disney didn't want to move forward because of the price.
It was too big of a risk.
Well, I think when you're Disney, you can afford anything.
Right.
Whereas, like, they're starting a whole channel. They're starting a whole streaming service, so that they don't have to pay Netflix and other places.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with making movies for this amount of money, man. Sometimes people get left out. And this is exactly the problem. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that good? Because it sounds like, and all of this stuff was interesting, right? It sounds like it was going to be a promising thing. And now, as a result of some financial bureaucracy, it's not happening. People are getting deprived of a good movie, potentially.
Yeah, I at the same time, I can't say it was like the wrong decision, because I feel like it could have ended up like that. Also, like another Zack Snyder movie, the one about the owls, the guardians of ghoulies or whatever it is.
Okay, yeah.
You know, it could be like where it's like very, or Rango or something like that. You know, it could be like very visual, very awesome to look at with a lot of fans, but it like might end up being like a cult classic. And you can't be a cult classic when you have a budget of $170 million.
Yeah.
Which is a shame. But what I do find interesting is sort of these creators, and this has happened before. Before Deadpool became a movie, the Tim Miller, who was the director of the first Deadpool, did a pre-visual sequence of the freeway fight, and then when Fox wasn't going to move forward with a Deadpool movie, put that footage on YouTube, and that got the fans like really excited, like, look how awesome this is. And then like 2 years later, like almost literally 2 years later, we get the Deadpool movie, and it becomes an $800 million box office success. And I wonder if somebody was thinking the same thing here. We're going to take this Mouse Guard stuff, which I thought was awesome, looked awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe we can generate some fan excitement, and, you know, maybe we can get Disney or somebody to reconsider. But
Yeah. I guess I just don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it could be too. I mean, I think there are probably more vocal, passionate people who want to watch Deadpool than maybe Mouse Guard. I mean, Mouse Guard's a very specific taste. It's almost like, I don't want to say university level, but, you know, it does feel like something, you know, sort of not geared to a general audience in the same way Deadpool is. But, you know, look, if you look at this footage, it's astounding.
It's amazing, yeah. But this is the risk you take in Hollywood, right? Like when you're in the independent film world, I think it's a little bit less likely that something like this would happen, that that you could work on something for this long and then the rug gets pulled out from under you. So this is the risk of playing at this level as well, is that you can work this long and this hard on something, right?
Yeah.
The same way that Peter Jackson worked on The Hobbit for only like a year, and Guillermo del Toro got, you know, whatever, 5-6 years, whatever it was, right? So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's I think there's also some corporate engineering at play, because Arkea Studios is the company that releases Mouse Guard, and of course Disney has its own comic book studio. And you know, it's if that's the reason why, because there's probably not much difference in terms of price tag for Mouse Guard versus something like Toy Story 4 or Frozen 2. But it's a shame. I mean, maybe we'll be talking about the great Mouse Guard comeback in a couple of months.
And who is this director? I don't think I've ever heard of this.
Wes Bell. He did the Maze Runner trilogy.
Okay.
So, I mean, he has experience making something out of nothing, because Maze Runner was a successful trilogy. It's not a successful trilogy on par like the Dark Knight trilogy. But it still made money.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, we'll have to leave that there. We're going to come back in a sec and talk about fake films, maybe deep fakes, rewrites. I don't know. This is a very existential
episode. We'll debate how we want to approach this during the break. Yeah.
Absolutely. In the meantime, we're going to get queued up for our review later in the show. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU. You got a friend in me. Some other folks might be a little bit smarter than I am, big and stronger too, maybe, but none of them will ever love you the way I do. It's me and you, boy, and as the years go by, our friendship will never die. You're gonna see it's our destiny. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. And now we're going to see if it's our destiny that other actors will replace different actors in various movies.
But we know no one will replace Randy Newman.
You know what? I would have loved to have, like, because we'll get into it later, but, you know, the Randy Newman, it fits very well with, like, that first and maybe that second Toy Story, but it would have been more interesting if, like, they had chosen, like, someone to do a cover of it. As, like, we sort of see the progress, you know, we get into Toy Story 3 and Andy's grown up, and then we have an entirely new little girl.
Here we go with Randy Newman again.
Right. Anyway.
Yeah.
So this YouTube creator named Control Shift Face, very clever pun, released a deep fake. And Deepfake is this app that, you know, sort of lets you change faces, shall we say?
Is it? I thought it was a football maneuver.
It could be both. But he took a couple of clips from Terminator 2 and replaced Arnold Schwarzenegger's face with Sylvester Stallone's face. Now, does it look perfect? No. Does it look compelling? Perhaps.
Yeah. I'm kind of down the middle about this because who am I to, like, squash people's fun? You know what I mean? If they want to swap faces, it's like, let them do it. Just let them have their fun. But as soon as we start getting into lawsuits and litigations and this is my character and you're defaming my character and whatever, that's when the fun stops. And mm-hmm. I can really see people doing that because people really do do that. So
society is litigious for
it's,
sure.
Yeah, it's maybe sinister foreshadowing because I think... Mm. Or maybe they won't take this very far. Maybe it will just be like kind of a fun thing that people do on the side. But the Terminator 2 thing is kind of interesting. Personally, I don't see how you can have the full, like, it's funny seeing his face. I don't see how you can have the full comedic effect still having Arnold Schwarzenegger's voice over top of it, though. It's like right. It's just.
Well, I mean, that would be the next phase of this, would be have someone yeah. come in and do a Sylvester Stallone impression.
And then I'll be
I need your clothes, your wallet, and your bicycle. Or I don't know how he sounds, but, you know.
Yeah, and I'm definitely not doing mine, so let's move on from that.
Hey, I need your bike, I need your clothes. Yeah.
I need your bike.
I gotta I gotta find John Connor. he's going to save the future, you know.
Does Mr. Control Shift know about you?
If he does, he shouldn't.
Yeah.
I'm no Rich Little.
No, I disagree. He should know. But...
ask your grandparents about Rich Little. I mean, we're kind of halfway there because I think the angle is like not in, like YouTube creators who can put like maybe Keira Knightley's face on the Terminator, let's say, just for kicks and giggles.
Sure.
But, I think... Hollywood is halfway there already because you think of something like Rogue One where you have Peter Cushing being recreated computerly, having young Carrie Fisher being recreated in the computer, or even something like Terminator Genesis where you have old Arnold Schwarzenegger fight young Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Mm-hmm.
And does this get to the point where we wanted to cast Benedict Cumberbatch for this role, but he's not available, so we're going to have... you scale actor come in and do all the actions and do all the scenes, and then we're just gonna paste Benedict Cumberbatch's face on you.
No, that does not sound beyond the realm of possibility for Hollywood at all. I would totally anticipate that they would do something like that.
So I mean that's the scary part, I think, in all this is
Yeah, and then you're not even focused on these wonderful works of art that took people so long to do. You're just like
right.
Oh, look how Arnold Schwarzenegger's face doesn't look like him. And it's like, you're focusing on the wrong part of the art is what I'm saying.
Right.
But it is kind of a funny concept. I'll give it that.
Well, it's a funny concept.
Or gimmick, I would say.
Sure. I mean, as a gimmick, yes. It's just, you know, we keep sort of like pushing the technology one way. And I figure you mm-hmm. being the spokesman for... the arts, keeping the arts in the media arts, this could come down to just another one of these like facets, you know, where great things sometimes come out of not being able to cast the person you wanted. Yeah. Hugh Jackman can attest to that. Dougray Scott was going to play Wolverine in X-Men, but because shooting on Mission Impossible 2 ran long, they went with Hugh Jackman instead. Hugh Jackman owes his entire career to a fluke. Now, what suppose in a world where, you know, you could just paste Dougray Scott's face on somebody, you know, you don't get Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I think, you know, it hasn't become a thing yet. I remember when they had, like, they were doing the thing with, like, dead actors selling vacuum cleaners. Like, they had Fred Astaire dancing with a Hoover, and they had... I think it was Laurence Olivier who played the villain in Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. Like there was this period of time. They're just going to bring them all back. They're going to bring them all back. And then, you know, acting is dead. And I mean, that sort of hasn't been entirely the case, but you know, when you have, the de-aging technology, you know, when you have like Michael Douglas and Kurt Russell playing younger versions of themselves in Marvel films, The Irishman, where you have technology, you know, why even bother with that now? You can just hire, you know, young actors, pay them scale, and then paste young Bob De Niro's face on somebody, young Joe Pesci's face on somebody, young Harvey Keitel's face, because all that footage exists.
Yeah, and if it works narratively, right, like if mm-hmm. in the case of people passing away, maybe, like mm-hmm. you can use that. If it works in a narrative way, I'm totally for it. I just, I see some downsides to it as well.
Because theoretically, you could keep on having Paul Walker in Fast and Furious movies.
You can, yeah. Or, well, no, I guess you could.
I mean, the other option is no Paul Walker in Fast and Furious. But, you know, theoretically, you can do this. And they kind of already did that for the scenes they had to, you know, shoot around him or use one of his brothers as a double or use old footage in order to finish Furious 7. And it just, you know, does it change the business in such a way where we're like completely mitigating risk?
Mm-hmm.
Because the risk is where a lot of really great movies come from, where, you know, Jaws. You know, you can make Jaws today because you'd be using a CG shark and sure. It would never fail and would never require Spielberg to be creative and use the barrels and
even the thing,
do the POV.
Like, the Thing is so good because he used practical creatures and monsters.
Yeah. And so I think that's, you know, we're sort of like gradually taking the fear of failure out of it more because we can, you know, the catch-all phrase,
way to put
fix it in post.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
But, I mean, the fear of failure isn't entirely gone in Hollywood because I think there are a couple of really good options for failing coming up later this year.
Not that succeeding is good. It's that failing is really bad in Hollywood.
Well, I'm not exactly rooting for success for a couple of these new trailers this week. So I want to save the best for last because I think Good Liar is like the most compelling of these.
Yeah, it has the most integrity of all of them. I agree.
Yeah.
I'll agree to that.
So let's talk about Midway, which is Roland Emmerich doing World War II, which I think is like, it's low rent, Michael Bay.
Here's a man that has a lot of respect for historical integrity, right? The Patriot, didn't he make
Patriot
the British look like total Nazis at all?
Well, he also had the Mel Gibson character in The Patriot is also based on a guy who was a slaveholder and not one of the kind ones, if there's such a thing as a kind slaveholder. But, of course, in the movie, he automatically earns the respect of the slaves he owns because he's such a good master. And
entertaining movie, but like you can understand Roland Emmerich's psychology in all of his movies, right? Like aliens, humans, good guys, bad guys, good, evil, right? It's like British Americans. And it's just, it's always so simple. So we know that this is going to be simple too, right?
The thing
it's
that
going
slays
to be like,
me about The Patriot is the scene right before the final battle where Donald Logue, who's been like the most racist out of all the troops under Mel Gibson's command, is standing next to the guy who's like, well, is the slave, but he's basically fighting for his freedom because there is this thing where you fought in the revolution, you run your way to freedom. And he's like,
he had sneered at that. And like,
I'm really honored that I'm fighting by your side in this battle. It's like, really?
This character arc went,
really?
Yeah.
No, you're not. You're calling him every N-word in the book behind his back and to his face. But leaving that aside, getting back to Midway. I feel it's...
So we know he's going to be like... And they already kind of advertised it, right? When they attacked our freedom.
Yes.
They attacked our freedom, man. They love to parade that word around.
They love to attack our...
Yes.
And this feels like the sequel to Pearl Harbor nobody wanted.
Yeah.
And I have like... major problems with Pearl Harbor, not the least of which is the scene where Yamamoto like looks out over the shore and sees the kids flying the kites and he goes, I know, an aerial assault.
But what if we digitally put Ken Watanabe over? Okay, so like I'm just saying,
Better movie question mark.
Yeah, no. So this is like Roland Emmerich spectacle. Once again,
it's going to be it's like the Independence Dayification of.
I'm glad he's still doing this. Yeah,
it's. I mean, this probably plays to his wheelhouse better than Stonewall.
What was that?
It's the movie he made about the Stonewall riots in '69.
Oh, okay.
You didn't hear of it because
Roland Emmerich has done many bad historical movies. Apparently,
His one about the Shakespeare conspiracy theory.
Oh, Anonymous.
Anonymous.
With,
it wasn't...
Michael Fassbender?
Was Fassbender in it?
Maybe not.
I think Reese... Biffens was in it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But it wasn't terrible. I don't think it was terrible. Mm-hmm. I think it's silly as hell, but it's not terrible.
He also doesn't write these scripts as well. Like, no. He just takes the scripts and then makes it.
Right. But I mean, as director, he obviously has like some
sort
of influence.
He may have some influence, yes.
To how good or bad the script is.
True.
Yeah, it's like bad. It's like...
So I'm dying to see how this unfolds historically. They attack their freedom. I want to know. I have
oh,
to
you
know.
Don't know how World War II ended?
No.
You're trying to avoid spoilers?
Well, isn't that what Roland Emmerich movies are for, man? To get your history lesson.
Yeah, I feel like...
I'm going to Midway, and then I'm going to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, getting another history lesson from Mr. Tarantino.
So. That's right. Okay. Don't spoil how the Manson trial ended for Vince. Yeah, I don't know who's looking forward to this. I don't know how like you get Aaron Eckhart and Patrick Wilson and Dennis Quaid and Woody Harrelson into the same room for this.
Are they trying to capitalize on this? Like, is it the climate in the country? People are divided. They're trying to put out a sappy patriotism movie. It's like...
Maybe.
I don't know. I just think it's so...
But, you know...
One-sided all the time.
Well, I mean, we've been making World War II movies since... since there was a World War II, pretty much the minute there was a World War II. I mean, Casablanca is a World War II movie that was released during World War II.
Right.
But it just, yeah. And it also feels like we're constantly releasing Charlie's Angels movies for no reason.
I just like, if I have to watch one more scene of the strafing planes that are strafing down, gunning with those CGI like bullets. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to check out, yeah.
I notice how we try to get into Charlie's Angels and you automatically start talking about Midway again.
Sorry.
But it's Kristen Stewart, Naomi Scott, and Ella Belinska, who I'm not really familiar with, but they are playing the Angels. Elizabeth Banks is directing and starring as Bosley, because it seems like there's multiple Bosleys. And it just, like, it feels like they've been doing like the same version of... Because I was a fan of the original Charlie's Angels. It was on at lunchtime when I would come home for lunch.
Okay.
So I'd come home for lunch and watch Charlie's Angels and eat my lunch. Because I lived 5 minutes away from my high school. So
it was very convenient.
It was convenient, yeah. So what was I going to do? Hang out with a cafeteria with a bunch of people I hated or go home and watch Charlie's Angels?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. Very clear, folks.
Yes. <it's, laughs> there was no Sophie's Choice situation.
No. I never did see the original one.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not remember the
McGee.
Bill Murray remakes or whatever.
Well, I mean, that's just my point. It's like there was a TV show remake a couple of years ago. And then now there's this remake. And then there was the McGee movies. And I feel like those three things are sort of have done like the same spin. Like the original Charlie's Angels series made in the mid 70s, it was what they called like jiggle TV, where it was all about seeing like beautiful women in like gowns and bikinis and all that. But you know, at its heart, there was this 70s era feminist message that here were these three women who were in the police force, were sort of mitigated, were sort of ostracized, you know, you can't be a cop because you're a woman. They end up striking out on their own, working for this mysterious Charlie person, and end up being allowed to sort of be fully effective on their own without the man machine in the police force. Now it's just like everything is like Mission Impossible-ized. They have all these tech things, and it's like, no, the show was small. The show was small. They were private investigators doing private investigator things. Now they're like saving the world and capturing like cyber weapons.
Well, it comes back to the idea that they think bigger is better, and it's like
not necessarily.
No.
Right. It just bothers me, and I mean not the concept of Charlie's Angels bothering me, but like having to take the concept and just like stretching it in ways that are silly and Jonathan Tucker's the villain.
Remind me what he's done.
Jonathan Tucker, let me look up his IMDb, because he's done like he's one of these guys who pops up in things. That was, you recognize him when you see him. He had a show recently.
He's like a Bill Fichtner.
He was in he was in The Virgin Suicides. That's one of his things. He was in Sleepers. He's currently in City on a Hill. He was in Kingdom, the show about MMA fighting. Justified. He did an episode, a couple of episodes of Royal Pains.
Okay, so a lot of TV credits.
Yeah, he said like he was in the Black Donnellys, which was what's his face's show, Paul Haggis's show. So I mean,
like, we were just talking about how like risk averse they are, and this is another proof of that. It's like, why are you think you're mitigating risk by doing what people are familiar with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stop people from like doing those very difficult things, like getting to know characters and their motivation. And things like that, and just give them what they recognize and they're familiar with all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as I can see, you know, go ahead and be complicit with this. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
But
I mean, we were talking before the show that the one thing that's going to come out of this is like the single that they have with Ariana Grande, Miley Cyrus, and Lana Del Rey. And like that's the thing that's going to be remembered for. Like a lot of people remember the Destiny's Child track from the McGee Charlie's Angels.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think a lot of people particularly remember Charlie's Angels, the movie. And that leaves The Good Liar, the new Bill Condon movie starring Ian McKellen as a con artist and Helen Mirren as the rich old widow he's trying to swindle. Or will he swindle her? Or will his past catch up with him?
So this is not about the premiere of Ontario. Is that what you're saying? No, I'm kidding. No.
Zing.
Bill Condon, of course, the great, wrote one of my all-time favorite screenplays of all time, Gods and Monsters.
Yes.
Of course, Oscar winner for Chicago. Mm-hmm. This is a man that didn't he do Beauty and the Beast though? He kind of fumbled that a bit. But ultimately, like this seems like a return to a more kind of intimate kind of character drama that he's very, very good at.
He did Mr. Holmes too. I mean, Beauty and the Beast is like one of those things you do where you get a paycheck and you get clout so that you can go and do stuff that...
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't begrudge him Beauty and the Beast. And it was certainly stylish, the Beauty and the Beast he did make. So, anyway.
That's fair.
So, go see Good Liar. Maybe not the other two. And go see Toy Story 4, or maybe not. You'll have to determine once we review it. We're going to come right back with that review. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Garden.
I knew it.
No, you're trying guys, to get listen, Bonnie in trouble.
No, of course not.
You could have been confiscated.
What does that mean?
Taken away.
No!
Or worse, you could have been lost.
No, guys, listen. Bonnie had a great day in class, and we're going on a road trip. Road trip?
Vacation!
Yeah!
But then something really weird happened. Bonnie made a friend in class.
What a
She's already making friends.
No, she literally made a new friend.
Hey, it's okay. Come on out. That's it. Come on, there you go.
Come on, let's get you out of there. You got this. Good, good. Everyone, I want you to meet Forky.
Golly, Bob Hat. Look how long his arms are.
And that was a clip from Toy Story 4. And it's a new film from Josh Cooley. And it features the voice talents of Tom Hanks, Tim Allen... Oh, I lost my place there. Tim Allen, Annie Potts, Tony Hale, Keegan-Michael Key, Jordan Peele, Christina Hendricks, and Keanu Reeves. I think calling this Toy Story 4 was a mistake.
Yes,
because it's
I
Woody's
agree.
Story.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Woody's
it
story.
Should have been Woody's story. You're absolutely right, yeah. And it even starts off kind of in an untraditional way. They normally do kind of like a kind of fantasy, fun fantasy sequence that kind of brings all the toys together. We see their kind of state at that time. And this one just kind of jumps straight into Woody and his life.
Yeah.
And it just kind of skips all that. And I was like, oh, we're just jumping into this, eh? We're not going to do anything fun with the intro?
Yeah, it's like, because Bo Peep was conspicuously missing from Toy Story 3. And, you know, toys get lost and toys get sold and toys get given away. And so, you know, you kind of move past it because it was supposed to be the last one. And then you have at the beginning of this, the flashback sequence to, like, the kidnapping of Bo Peep. Bo Peep is sold to this collector or someone who's buying it to give to their child or something. And, you know, it's in the middle of this, like, kind of harrowing rescue sequence where they're trying to rescue RC, who's like in like a drainage ditch or something and getting flown away by the current, and yeah, the toys are trying to rescue him.
Yeah.
And it's this really like almost dark sequence.
Yeah.
And it's like dark because it takes place at night. And it's dark because it's, you know, RC's in danger, and then Bo Peep gets like taken away.
And then later when they go to the antique shop, it gets kind of darker still. There's this kind of weird Elizabethan or Victorian like kind of atmosphere about the whole thing as well. I wonder if they brought on new writers who kind of influenced the tone or the direction of these films.
Yeah, and it's not just the writers too, because it's like the craftsmen, the artists, the animators who like that sequence with, because it takes place on like a rainy night. Mm-hmm. It's, I think it's probably some of the best animation Pixar's ever done, and the antique store too, like the dust bunnies and the cobwebs.
Yeah,
like it just all feels so tan, and even the lighting, like when they're walking, but like between the crevices and they're walking behind cases and you see how the, you know, there's dark spots and just places where light can get through. It's all very tangible in a real realistic way.
The animation is always gorgeous. Absolutely. Yeah. Like I never doubted them for a minute. It's just that the story for me this time does not add up. And it's like, this is exactly what I feared, man. This is exactly what I feared, that they were going to take this too far and they were going to blemish this absolutely beautiful masterpiece of technology and storytelling that I have grown up with since 1995. It's like, I don't think this one needed to exist. I don't think it says anything quite as profound as the other ones, to be honest.
And that's why I think the branding is off, you know, to call it Toy Story 4, because it's not I was reading some of the comments and they kind of reflected what you said, that it's, you know, a lot of the other toys getting mitigated, you know.
Yeah.
Buzz, there's not a lot with like Buzz, there's not a lot with Jesse and like Rex and the other toys. It's sort of uniquely focused on Woody and Bo and this Forky character. And then we meet new characters later on, including this like stuffed bunny and duck who are kind of stuck together, who are played by Key and Peele. It's just an entirely different story that it's set in the Toy Story universe with the Toy Story characters, but it's an entirely different enterprise.
They don't really need, I felt like they were just throwing in characters just because they needed to kind of liven up the characters a bit. They needed to add in a little bit more. And it's like,
maybe
the other ones, I felt they always served a purpose, right? We're going into the daycare. These toys are a part of the daycare. This time, right, I felt like it was just random. It was too random, right? Even Bonnie, okay, we start off, we pick up after Toy Story 3. Bonnie is going to daycare, right? She makes this spork kind of toy or whatever.
Yep.
And I was just kind of confused. I was like, why did he come to life? What are the rules now of this universe? Can you make toys come to life? And I thought they were going to go deeper into the themes of that, right? He's having an existential crisis, Forky, because he doesn't know what he is. Am I a toy or am I just whatever? But they didn't do that at all. They just kind of, I don't know, just let it go. And there was too much trying not, like, avoiding humans too. It was like trying not to, like, get humans to notice you, I find. And it's like the emphasis on the toys and what it means to be a toy and how being a toy also can relate to being a human being, I think, are lost.
Right.
There's just too many gags about, like...
I think there's almost too much of that. Like, there's almost too much of, like, the toys, like, having effects on the human world.
Yes.
And, like, being
interactive
you're
right,
with
actually.
The human world.
Maybe I didn't articulate that better, but that's, right. that's correct. Yeah. They were trying to influence, and, like, it's almost like they're... What's a comparable character? I don't know. That's just standing by and kind of influencing things
right.
that's going on in the world. But yeah, you're right.
No, and I didn't mind the amount of Forky we got, but it does open the door into interesting questions. Like to hear Forky kind of explains his existence at one point. He's like, you know what? I'm a spork. You use me to eat a salad or a soup. Maybe a chili, and then you throw me in the trash. And the way he explains trash, how it's like warm and comforting, and it's like
yeah. But then it just like so
it
so
drops
he's spending
the whole, yeah they drops
yeah.
The whole thing.
It's like okay, he's trying to jump into the trash for literally the first 40 minutes. That's all he's doing. And then why doesn't he like what? He doesn't come to some great realization. It's
right.
just like he just stops doing it. And so the writing is not as smart as it used to be. I feel. Or in the previous entries. And
it's still, I mean, I still found it affecting.
Yeah, I found it entertaining, yeah.
Yeah, when you get to the end, and I won't spoil the end, but, you know, the end was still, like, really emotional because of all the time you spent with these characters, I found.
Well, that's why it was emotional,
right.
I feel. Not because they... effectively set it up in that movie, but because you
right.
have your own kind of attachment to these characters.
Right. Yeah, and on that level, I think it still works. I think that the what they wanted to do, I think where they end up, where the film ends up and where it begins are not necessarily the same place. Like, you don't see the like, obvious progression.
I don't think they knew where it was going. They just started...
They might
like,
not have.
...going and...
And there's been a lot of, you know, behind-the-scenes stuff, like the pushing back release dates, changing release dates of other Pixar movies, because other movies come together faster than other movies. And it just... I was like you. I went into this thinking, like, why are you besmirching the epicness of the trilogy and the accomplishment of the trilogy. But I came out of this saying, like, okay, I can see a reason why this exists and why it should exist. But I don't think it's Toy Story 4. And I think that's sort of the key problem with the movie, if there is a problem. Because I can also see why people come out of this. Like, I loved it, no problem. But I think in terms of, you know, not understanding, at least on the writer and the creator's part, you know, how much is this a Toy Story movie and how much of this is a story about moving on and people, you know, trying to decide for themselves what their own fate is, because that's also ultimately what it comes down to.
And that's kind of what the Bo Peep storyline is, I feel. Like, she's more of kind of a free spirit wandering vagabond kind
right.
of thing. And, you know, I thought they were going to play with the themes of, like, you don't have to live this life where you are attached to a kid.
Right.
So I feel like there is some conflict in what they're trying to say. On one hand, they're like, no, it's cool. You can live a life like Bo Peep where you're not attached to this. But then every 5 seconds, you're beating me over the head with these toys going, I want a kid. I want a kid. I want to be played with by a kid. So it's
right.
like, what are you actually trying to say? I don't know. And then the ending, I felt, was very unsatisfying for that reason, the decision that Woody ends up making.
Right. They play very loosely with, I think, what has been pre-established text with the film, which is that the point of a toy is to be loved by a kid.
Right.
And if you're a lost toy, then you are like some sort of purgatory toy. And if you're like the daycare in Toy Story 3, the idea is like you like to be in this environment where you have like dozens of kids sort of like picking at you and tearing at you.
Yeah.
It's kind of almost like toy hell in a way. And,
but Yeah, and they set it up. They always set it up really nicely. It's like they're seemingly very nice and warm and comforting, right? And they did this in number two with Al's Toy Barn, right? The characters are always kind of warm and friendly. And then you discover they have very sinister intentions, right? And three, Buzz Lightyear overhears their conversation. And they have some very sinister intentions. This one, it's like, okay, we're in a creepy antique shop. It's sinister right off the bat. We know exactly where this is going. There's no surprise about what these people are going to do, right?
Although I did like Gabby's arc.
We didn't even talk about that really, and I didn't actually. So her like voice box, she's like an old toy. Her voice box has kind of worn out, and Woody's is obviously like really
in prime condition.
Really
yeah.
in prime condition, so yeah. she's trying to like get his. And it's like, why? What are they trying to say there?
Right. And the backstory of Gabby, how she was defective out of the box. And, you know, it lends to the sort of fickleness of kids that, you know, if something doesn't work. And it's part of Duke Kaboom's backstory as well. That his, by the way, perfect marriage of character and actor, Duke Kaboom.
Yeah.
But it's part of Duke Kaboom's backstory that he did not work the way the toy commercials made it seem. And the kid kind of, what is the kid named? Rochot, I think.
Rajon.
And that he doesn't work perfectly out of the box, or he doesn't function like the toy commercial says, and the kid automatically abandons him. But I mean, that's another idea that's not really
fleshed out. And then he tries to have this like redeeming moment at the end. But again, all of that is around, like, their big plan is centered around not being, like, spotted by humans. And the more they did that, the more I was just like, why? Why is it so important that you're not identified by humans? Because they're going to rush to CNN and going to, like, release this as a big news story. Oh, it's on Insta. I just don't think it's, like, that important of an element, right? Like, why do you keep doing it? So... I don't know. But I was kind of disappointed with the whole thing. I gotta be honest.
I wasn't disappointed with it, actually. I left feeling rather elated. I enjoyed the emotional journey.
Maybe I'm just getting cynical with old age.
Could be. I enjoyed and the artistry of this too. I think it's such a beautiful movie to look at. All the detail. I'm glad they made it. I wish that they sort of had a better grasp on the story. I think there was a lot of potential, but I wish they sort of had a better grasp on the story they wanted to tell. I think that the story was satisfying, but there were areas that they could have tightened, or, you know, they could have easily replaced Forky with like one of the other toys sort of going missing, and there are things they could have done where maybe. You sort of feel that John Lasseter, despite his tremendous personal defaults,
yes,
you know, might have been able to massage this into something that was maybe a worthy successor to the other three. Not that it isn't a worthy successor, but sort of recontextualize it and put it in a different place.
I think this is the like worst Toy Story. You don't think that?
I think it's the worst Toy Story, but we're grading on the curve because I think the best Toy Story film is still better than the best Police Academy film.
Or
maybe in context, like the worst Toy Story film is still better than the best Cars film.
I guess that was the wrong way to put it. This was the least satisfying Toy Story film.
I think that's fair. I was satisfied.
So where do you draw the line? If it's like, okay, if it's good enough, then what's stopping them from like keeping going again and again and again? When do we like, you know, put a fork in it and call it done? It's like
that.
I say when you cannot honor the integrity of or the quality and the standards of the previous like things that you have set for yourself, you need to like call it done. And that's what they have done here. They have fallen short of all of the ideas and the story that they have previously set up.
Well, that will have to be a question for another time because we are at the end of the show. And we hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can also download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, or you can get it through one of your podcast apps at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Vince, where can people find you on the internets?
Twitter at VMassin5.
All right. And I will be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for Thursday's Open Sources Guelph. That's News and Politics with Scotty Hertz and me. And in the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming. And there is great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. And we will see you then.